You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Oh, big sandwich there. From the 9 and the 2, and now it's on.
Irwindale Speedway is home to NASCAR, hot rods, street stock, enduro drags, and Formula D racing. But once a year, the track hosts a unique event that is a brutal, magnificent thing to behold. It's a demolition derby, and not just any old smash-em-up, but specifically the Derby Divas, all-female demolition derby to benefit breast cancer research. Well, the ladies are here to support the cause, of course, but beyond that, they are climbing behind the wheel for different reasons. Some of them are first-timers looking for a high-adrenaline night of destructive mayhem. Others are derby veterans whose allegiance to the track has become a lifestyle. And then there's Becca Doyle, who's been through a wreck that had nothing to do with a derby and was not entertaining.
For me, I feel like I'm the underdog in every event because, you know, I'm a demo derby driver with PTSD and a car accident. Like, what an oxymoron. Like, that makes no sense. So I always feel like for me, it's every time I get in these cars, it's a bit of a redemption for myself. Almost like an FU to the guy who hit me.
If the cure for being hit is to hit back, there'll be plenty of opportunity for therapy. It is an all-out battle for mechanical survival between 13 women in 13 cars. Reporter Peter Gilstrap witnessed the chaos, the fury, and the glorious flaming destruction in what may be the most American sport of all.
The Irwindale Speedway Grandstand is filled with thousands of people hungry for destruction. After a full night of standard races, meaning cars that just go around in a circle real fast, the place is humming with energy. It feels like a Saturday night at the county fair. The air smells like a mixture of cotton candy vape smoke, gasoline, and real cotton candy. But in the pit behind the track, the Derby Divas stand around their cars under the lights, bored and nervous. Their crews of friends and family members make last-minute tweaks to the aging rides, Nissans and Hondas, Fords and Buicks, making sure they can run one last time. They need to survive through 20 minutes of sheer driving hell.
My name is Cheryl Hyland from Hawthorne, California, also known as the Queen of Destruction at Irwindale Speedway.
That one, this one, they all have check engine lights are still on them because these literally come from the junkyard.
Except, you also have giant eyelashes on the front of your...
As you can see, I have them. That's my signature.
Each car is decked out with the driver's personalized touches. They look like small discount parade floats.
We get to paint them however we want to. That's always my favorite part is decorating them. I like to put a little sparkle on my cars. And then we just go out and destroy them.
There's a Buick Century painted up like a cop car. It says Party Patrol on the side, with big red beer pong solo cups stuck on the roof. There's also a car with a furry, life-sized unicorn head mounted on the roof. You're going to want to remember that for later. It all seems like part performance art, part Viking funeral.
I always think it's really funny that somebody went to the car lot and bought this car. Brand new, really excited, they got their brand new car. And they have no idea this is the send-off it's going to get. It's going to get crushed, and people are going to watch it, and they probably had great memories in this car. It's going to get one hell of a send-off.
My name is Nicole Emma, and I'm from Burbank, California, born and raised. And I'm here, my second derby. Try and win it this time.
What made you want to start doing this?
I ran out of other crazy stuff to do. I'm not married, no kids. All the times you want to just slam into people on the freeways, you can do it here, so... It's a lot of aggression getting released.
In 2019, I was on the 101 freeway and I was in dead stop traffic. And a car never stopped, never saw the traffic. And he hit the rear end of my car going 50 miles an hour. And that left me with substantial injuries. But it also left me with very severe PTSD in cars.
Doyle tried talk therapy. She tried anti-anxiety meds. Then she had a breakthrough idea, demolition derby.
I'm just going to try it. I'm just going to see if this helps. If I show myself that I can have all these extra car accidents and walk away from it and be okay, maybe this will change things for me. To me, it means the world because, like I said, there's so few women in this sport and in motorsports in general. So it's very empowering to come together with women that are similar to you, have a similar interest. It's rare to find people like that. You know, I think if I were to go up to a random woman in Target and be like, do you want to drive in a demolition derby with me? They'd think I'm missing all my nuts and bolts up there.
The guys that I race with, they treat me like anybody else. I haven't had any backlash as far as being a woman in racing. They've all embraced it.
You definitely get some double looks like, oh, there's a woman out there. Like, that's different. Like, you're different. And I welcome it because when I was a little girl, there were no women for me to cheer for. So it helps me want to even drive better knowing that I'm the person those little girls up in the stands are looking up to that day.
You know, the women come out and like, you go, girl, like, that you can do this too. Anybody can do this.
People want to see destruction, so give them destruction.
Let me ask you something, Cheryl. Do you think there's anything about being a female that gives you any kind of edge in demolition derby over men?
You know what? I think we're more aggressive. I'll be honest with you. You'll see tonight. I've been in co-ed derbies. I've seen them. They kind of chase each other around. I don't know what it is. Hormones? I don't know. We just have that something to prove. We got a lot of pent-up anger. I don't know, but we just got there and let it go.
And now it's time to let it go. The drivers put on their helmets and climb into their vehicles, quite literally. The windows have been removed and the doors are welded shut. Other than the driver's seat, inside the cars are stripped of everything, and that includes dashboard stereos, which can quickly become flying projectiles. But that means no personal soundtrack to destruction.
If you were able to play something in the car, what would you choose?
AC/DC is good. Yeah, it works.
Which song?
TNT.
I'm dynamite.
They line up in formation, gun the engines, and head toward the field of battle. And then it's on. The cars are cordoned off in a small area in the middle of the track for maximum contact. There's nowhere to hide. And you can't just sit. You've got to keep moving or risk disqualification. They're ramming each other in reverse and slamming head on. Bumpers get ripped away. Fenders go flying. Tires blow out and drivers continue on rims alone. Wheels pop off and roll aside slowly, teetering like cartoon wreckage. Axles break. Rotors grind. Radiators overheat, spouting smoke and water. And the transmissions... Good God, the wounded transmissions. They stick and grind and scream, struggling to get into gear, fighting to survive. It's total vehicular carnage. One by one, the cars die off as the field narrows. Now, thick red curtains of sparks spew from the underbellies of the few remaining rides as they make sounds you just never hear cars make in real life. The crowd laps it up like ancient Romans as the clock ticks down. Derbies usually end just like a pistol duel or America's Next Top Model. The last one standing is the winner. But this derby is timed out and judged on battering skill and demolition finesse. And now, as the smoke from dead engines drifts across the track, littered with twisted auto parts like a Mad Max battlefield, the winner is declared. But it's not Becca or Cheryl or Maria or Nicole. It's car number 93, driven by Derby diva Jesse DeNike. And then, coming through the mayhem, there's Nicole.
So how was it?
It's brutal. I mean, they like demolish you. I love it. It was awesome. Beer.
Do you ever feel sorry for the car?
I did feel a little bit sorry for the unicorn. I saw a unicorn go flying and I was like, oh, hi.
I drove that car hard. I drove it hard and I lost my front tire, so I was sparking it up a storm. I kind of became a human sparkler, but doing the demo derby helped seal the deal for me to take that next step in my healing progression.
So it was a positive night for Becca Doyle and her PTSD. And all those little girls in the grandstand with visions of demolition in their heads had someone to cheer for. For KCRW, I'm Peter Gilstrap in Irwindale.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Yesterday on an episode of GLA, we talked about the value of planting native plants in a time of climate change, and also efforts by the San Diego Zoo to bring back threatened species of butterflies and moths. Well, here in LA, the zoo here, which is inside Griffith Park, is also involved in animal conservation. Most famously, it's helped bring back the California condor from the brink of extinction. The new zoo, if you can call it that, has been around since the 1960s, and the folks there think, well, now is a time for a major upgrade to the tune of about $650 million. They're calling it the 20-year vision plan. But the plan is getting some pushback, and here to talk about it is Denise Verrett, director of the LA Zoo. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here today.
And Jerry Hans is president of the Friends of Griffith Park, which has been critical of the zoo's plans. Jerry, thank you for coming on as well.
Thank you, Steve.
Tell us, Denise, about the 20-year vision plan. I'm sure there's a lot involved. I know there's a parking structure involved and some other things. Give us some highlights, if you would.
Certainly. So in 2016, we set about developing this vision plan that is intended to transform our physical campus and create the zoo of tomorrow for the community. We developed this plan with intentionality and community engagement. And the idea is to improve welfare for the animals with state-of-the-art animal habitats and veterinary support facilities, advance and demonstrate our conservation efforts, exhibiting the California condor for the first time in our history, incorporate sustainability and design practices that will demonstrate our commitment to green efforts, and advance learning and engagement experiences for the many students that visit the zoo as part of a field trip, and then improve our circulation and wayfinding and focus on accessibility to our diverse population that we serve.
So these are wildlife areas where the animals would be sort of in an environment akin to where they would be naturally.
Absolutely. And this plan actually increases the space for animals by 270%, going from 22 acres to 59 acres. We were built in 1966, and we have a lot of those original exhibits still standing today that definitely need to be transformed to be what a modern zoo is today and into the future.
You know, a lot of folks may not know that the city of LA owns the zoo, right? It's owned and operated by the city. And we're talking about $650 million as a price tag. It's a lot of money for a city that has a lot of problems, even if it's spread out over a long period of time, which is your 20-year plan. How do you plan to raise the funds for this?
Right. So, you know, one piece at a time. The last master plan that we implemented took 17 years. It cost $172 million, and it provided much needed upgrades throughout the zoo. And we did it in a public-private partnership between the City of Los Angeles, as well as our nonprofit support organization. And we would be looking at a similar model. I know $650 million sounds like a lot of money, because it is, but it will be taken one piece at a time as funding is available.
So you're talking like a capital campaign, things like that?
Absolutely, a capital campaign, and then support from the city and any public funding that's available that can support the plan's implementation.
Jerry Hans, your organization, Friends of Griffith Park, along with the California Native Plant Society, has been critical of this plan. Tell us what you're concerned about.
Yes, Steve, and other organizations as well. Everyone wants the very best care for zoo animals, and the modernization of these facilities is definitely needed. It's part of the full plan, but it's also part of Alternative One, which is the plan that we support. However, from the conservation perspective, there's really no good justification for destroying 23 acres of native habitat. Within those 23 acres, there's 227 protected native trees, and they include Southern California black walnut, which is rare, and coast live oak. These trees are all listed under the city protected tree ordinance. But, you know, what's really telling is that the vast majority of those 23 acres under the zoo's proposed project would be developed for visitor amenities and revenue-generating attractions. Only 35% of it really goes towards animal space and care.
Denise, how do you respond to those kinds of concerns when he's talking about, you know, 23 acres and all of these things that you know, that go onto a preservation list and shouldn't be touched?
As it relates to the undeveloped acreage, we have no intentions of simply destroying these areas. The plan specifically states that to the maximum extent feasible, on-site native vegetation communities and special status plant species shall be protected and preserved in place, and design plans shall be amended to avoid disturbance or loss of these biological resources. When we get into the actual design of the project, because right now the vision plan is just that. It envisions what we might actually do. So there's going to be plenty of opportunity to engage with the public in the design process, to be transparent every step of the way. And we welcome the opportunity to have community partners such as the Friends of Griffith Park and others join us in that process when we get to that point.
Jerry, what do you say to the director saying that they are going to take extra precautions to make sure that those native species and,
yes,
and you know, fauna, flora exist and continue to exist there?
Well, this is going to the council for approval very soon. And if Alternative One is not specified and the full project is approved, then the entire 23 acres of woodlands and natural habitat is subject to being lost. So Alternative One sort of sets a hands-off rule for that acreage right up front. Alternative One, to be clear, is a nice compromise. It only reduces the project size a very minor amount. So
Denise, is that a compromise, do you think, Alternative One?
The short answer is no, because we want the additional acreage so that we can provide for expansive animal exhibits and animal welfare to be achieved.
And again, the city council is going to have the say in this, right? They're the ones who are going to make this decision.
Yes, they are.
Well, thank you both for coming on the show and talking to us today. Denise Verrett, the director of the LA Zoo, Jerry Hans, president of the Friends of Griffith Park. Do be continued, of course. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. And before you let us go, let's celebrate one recently retired Angeleno. Earlier this month, reference librarian Glenn Creason turned in his ID badge at the Central Public Library in downtown LA. And he walked out those great big iron doors into retirement. He'd been working there for 42 years. Now imagine going to the same place to work for so long. That place becomes, yeah, a second home. Your coworkers become a second family. It can be hard to leave.
You know, it was time for me to retire. So I wrote this sort of as a, you know, sort of therapy.
Here is Glenn reading his farewell love letter to the Los Angeles Public Library.
I've had the rare vantage point of viewing downtown Los Angeles for four decades, not as a journalist or a reporter, but serving from a cultural crow's nest. Until last Friday, I was a reference librarian in the history department at the Central Library, smack in the middle of our metropolis. Over the years, I've seen, heard, and smelled the big city like few others. I've met movie stars, music legends, famous writers, powerful politicians, and even a serial killer. Really. I spent more than half my life in that quirky building at Fifth and Flower. It's almost embarrassing to say, but I love my job and mostly look forward to coming into dear, dirty downtown to experience Los Angeles from the neglected broken hearts to the pinnacles of human achievement every workday. I had the privilege to sit at a reference desk for over 40 years, watching my neighborhood away from home change, sometimes spectacularly, but often grotesquely. I was so proud of my workplace, so ready to announce I worked at the big library downtown, that it broke me in two when the place burned in 1986. Most of my fellow workers survived, often painfully, and when the Grand Old Dame reopened in 1993, it was one of the happiest days of my life. I settled into my cubicle, then blinked, and here I am. I've been here for 8 presidents, 5 mayors, many numbers of Microsoft Windows, 3 Dodger championships, 11 Laker crowns, flip phones, smartphones, subways, a spectacular Olympics, a book, and the birth of a wonderful daughter. There were also the dark times of 2 catastrophic fires, the AIDS epidemic, the LA uprising, 9/11, a mental health sinkhole, and COVID. This grand old library was my refuge and inspiration through deaths, divorce, and depression. This precious village of Central has been tested, but always held together by folks who share my love for the true value of the old beauty. There is nothing quite like the variety in the ridiculous to the sublime public who visit libraries. I will miss the unpredictable curiosity of my patrons. Once, I could rattle off the mausoleum at Halicarnassus as one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, or patiently explain that I found no evidence that Columbus was wearing cufflinks when he discovered America. I learned so much from all these inquiring Angelenos that classrooms could never come close to these 500 months of instruction. There were plenty of inquiries I could not satisfy. The existence of the Nazi tarot deck, the location of the lizard people's golden tablets, the Jesuit maps of Los Angeles. I knew how crazy people were long before the internet made it crystal clear. More than ever, I'll miss those moments before the doors open and I had the old library to myself. It's weird how the smell of musty books can be soothing, even sensual sometimes. Susan Orlean described how the village of Central continues beautifully in her book, but the power of standing amidst the wisdom of our justifiably maligned race is an experience for the lucky few. As John Prine sang, how lucky can one man get? Touching on the true life of this library causes a great wave of nostalgia, a bittersweet longing for those deep friendships shuttered by death. Yet, it's time to dim the lights in the rotunda, close the great iron doors on Fifth Street, and leave tomorrow to another lucky soul.
Today I walk down a street I used to wander. Yeah, shook my hand and I made myself a bed. Well, there was all these things that I don't think I remember.
That was Glenn Creason, who worked as a librarian in the history department of the Central Library in downtown LA for 42 years. He retired earlier this month.
brushed my shoes and I hung them from a rearview mirror. Rod's admiration in a blast pot of a grill. Well, there was all these things that I don't think I remember.
That's going to do it for today. We're back tomorrow with another new episode and a tour of the largest tiny home village opening yet. That's tomorrow on GLA. Next week, ahead of the UN climate gathering in Scotland, we're devoting a handful of our episodes to the issue of climate change. And I know the news about warming temperatures and melting ice caps and sea level rise can leave you anxious, but there are people right at this very moment finding ways to make a difference. And maybe you know someone who's doing big things or small things to do their part. It can even be you. So tell us about that person at kcrw.com/GLA. And while you're there, get the show delivered fresh to your feed every time Greater LA drops. kcrw.com/GLA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear this evening. Have a great night.